Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore a very important topic, and that is a medicinal plant that kills malignant tumors and destroys 70% of breast cancer cells, yet it's non-toxic. You probably haven't heard of it, but there are hundreds of studies on it. Over 153 compounds have been reported from the seeds and the parts that you could eat. I'll give you the latest on that. Then we're going to look at fruits and vegetables reducing our risk of death from all causes. Then a vegan diet may reduce diabetic nerve pain. Also, 19 million Americans abuse prescription drugs. The FDA knows it, is doing nothing about it. And I'll give you an insight on what I believe was the problem with Robin Williams that was not in the media at all. I was driving throughout the night to get to my next location, and I was listening to the BBC, and they kept talking about the people calling in and or writing in comments about him and his career and their relationship with him. Not once did they mention the drugs he was on or why he might have been depressed or how we deal with depression. I will. Also, a hygiene practice most people ignore, and it's important for your health. I'll share that with you. Additionally, there's a new study, a good study on cannabis, slowing cancerous tumor growth. I'll share that and a lot more on health and healing. From our environmental segment today, a new study sees the Atlantic Ocean warming, and that's behind a host of recent climate shifts. But they did not talk about what is likely to happen if it continues. I will. Bottled water. Most people drink, who are aware of the importance of healthy, clean water, drinking bottled water, or filtering themselves, which is the better option. Well, bottled water comes from the most drought-ridden places in the country, and therefore you should pay attention to where you're drinking your water. I'll give you that map and show you where you should not buy bottled water. From our social issues commentary today, from Michael Maskin, TalkPoverty.org, no safe place, how cities are making it illegal to be homeless. Also, excuse me, today we will have a guest on the second part of our program. He is Professor Sandy Tolan, professor at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, University of Southern California, where over the years as a journalist has reported from over 30 countries during the past 28 years, Latin America, the Middle East, the Balkans, South and Southeast Asia. We're going to talk about the many changes the U.S. and Israel have to make in order to have a lasting peace in Gaza, but also why, what the Palestinians and the Jewish people want and need and deserve a lasting peace is being ignored and or sabotaged by the leaders within the Zionist Likud party and the Hamas terrorist organization. So the leadership has one agenda on both sides that is not working on behalf of their members. We'll have the discussion with him on that. As you see, we have a lot on our plate here. Let's begin. I'm always looking at what is natural and non-toxic as a way of helping people with illness. We study the scientific literature in depth. We look at those plants, herbs, vegetables, fruits, whatever they may be, or nutrients that have a good track record, that have some good science behind them, not just something that's speculative. Dr. Marianne Pochi sent a very good piece of research over that shows hundreds of studies on the efficacy and safety of what is called Brucea, B-R-U-C-E-A, Javanica, J-A-V-A-N-I-C-A. So write that down, because with your holistic physician or pharmacist or nutritionist or nurse, they'll have to get it for you. BRUCEAJAVANICA. It's one of those plans in which scientific investigations have provided enough evidence to prove that it has an impressive efficacy for the treatment of cervical, bladder, pancreatic, and breast cancers. In fact, its selective toxicity has also been found to kill 70% of breast cancer cells. Now, oncologists are still at a loss to find methods of selectively killing cancer cells through the standard protocols with radiation chemotherapy. They can kill cells, but they're killing 1,000 healthy cells for every cancer cell they kill. Hence, people die from the therapy, not just from the cancer itself. In fact, most people die from cancer therapies, and that's unfortunate, but it's the fact. This is a shrub, and it's just one of those plants that needs to be recognized. It's been researched. It's from Southeast Asia. It occurs in Sri Lanka, India, Indochina, Taiwan, Thailand, and even Northern Australia. And what they have found is that historically it's been used to help people with malaria, amoebic dysentery, and cancer. And the healing part of it has been heavily studied. In fact, a study published in the American Journal of Medical Science demonstrated the aqueous, which is a water-based extract from the plant, created programmed cell death in cancer cells. So it's really good. In fact, the American Journal of Chinese Medicine also published from the Department of Urology in University School of Medicine in China and found that it induces cancer cells, especially in the bladder, to die. They kill themselves, but not healthy cells. So I just want to share that because we do have people who have cancer in this audience or people who know people who have cancer, and I always want them to have the best information. Fruits and vegetables. I know many of you are eating your servings, fresh, organic, in season, locally grown wherever possible. Out of season, you can get them from other parts of the country or other parts of the world, and ideally, we're going to be moving towards hydroponics. Therefore, the amount of rain or sun, drought or poor soil, cold or flooding will not be a factor because you'll have 24/7 every day of the year. You'll have a controlled environment. Now, I'm building hopefully a model unlike any hydroponic house ever built. I'm growing lateral, vertical, horizontal. I'm growing 300% more than what a person can normally grow. One small hydroponic house will be able to produce about $100,000 worth of vegetables a year. So the idea that you can't make a living from it is a myth, or that it's too complicated. It is not. But to make it really easy for everyone, I'm going to be doing it in pixeled text, meaning I will do a photograph of every single stage of its construction, planting, time-lapse photography, from seed to sprout to harvest. There'll be a timeline and a spreadsheet showing you what the fair market value at the farmer's market, the health food store, the gourmet restaurant, or wholesaler is, and what size, how much you have to put out in order to build one or have one constructed. I'm looking at all the different dynamics, and this will be done within 5 to 6 months because I want to take it through a whole season to show you what is possible. And then my hope is that there will be a lot of people then beginning to do this, to shift away from what they were doing to so they are starting the process of re-educating themselves so they can have the next stage of their life. In any case, the idea is we should be having a lot more fruits and vegetables in our diet. And the British Medical Journal agrees. In a new article, they state, quote, fruits and vegetables reduce the risk of dying over an observed period of time up to 26 years. Wow. That is something. There's nothing known, not meditation, not de-stressing, not exercise, no medicine, no nutrient that could extend the life and keep you from dying for 26 years. But fruits and vegetables can. Quote, this is based upon a new meta-analysis. Researchers analyzed 16 separate studies, including one study that had 833,234 participants, and found that each serving of fruits and vegetables decreased the risk of dying by 5 to 6% respectively. That's each serving. Wow. So what does this mean? It means that what we've been sharing with you for as long as I've been teaching and sharing on health has been way ahead of the curve. And that's why some of you today look 20 years younger than your chronological age or your peers. That's why some of you who go to a reunion now become depressed when you see how everyone else looks and acts and then how vibrant and energetic and youthful you are. It is motivating younger people to realize that they don't have to grow older the same way their parents and grandparents did. So there is a whole lot of young people paying attention. In fact, my next three books are directed just for younger people and documentaries because they need those tools also. It means that every time you have your fresh fruits or vegetables or your compounded powders, which are even more powerful by multitude, that you are doing a great deal of service to your body. So keep your reds, keep your greens going into your body, and now we know the more you put in, the longer you prevent yourself from dying. And there it is, a very famous, you don't get any more famous as a journal than that. I mean, it's right up there with the Lancet, and, you know, it is acknowledged as one of the best in the world, one of the best five. So when they're saying it, and that's the British Medical Journal, and they've used 16 separate studies and with huge numbers of people, then pay attention. The fruits and vegetables, you just can't get enough. Following on that is a new report from the American Association of Diabetic Educators. And here's what it says, quote, a low-fat vegan diet may reduce pain associated with diabetic neuropathy. And they followed a diet for 20 weeks. It was vegan. And they found that there was a substantial improvement in people's diabetic neuropathy. So one more reason to make sure that you have fruits and vegetables, grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, and raw organic nut butters and sprouts and juices. A recent report, 19 million Americans abuse their prescription drugs. That's from the CDC. And every single day in America, 46 Americans die. Not from taking vitamins. Nobody dies from taking vitamins. Period. We have all the science on it. Now, the quackbusters and the other totally discredited fools that pretend they know something, but they are backed by the pharmaceutical companies, so they get mainstream coverage and actually go on television and pronounce things that are completely wrong. But the reality is, people are dying from drugs, prescription drugs, 46 a day. Now, that is a lot. That's from the overdosing. All right, drug overdosing, 46 a day. That's 17,000 people a year. Shouldn't we be paying attention to this? We should, but we're not. And that's because the pharmaceutical industry doesn't want people paying attention to it. But how can we not? Well, we cannot, because until someone famous dies, it's not important to us. So then Robin Williams kills himself. And then suddenly we think, okay, it was the depression that killed him. No, it wasn't the depression. Depression doesn't kill anyone. The therapies you take, or taking your own life because you're depressed, that kills you. Early this morning, when I got to my next location, about 4 o'clock, I read a report from a Dr. Bart Billings. Quote, "The media is now covering Robin Williams' suicide and can't understand why he would commit suicide. No one so far has even mentioned adverse effects of antidepressants. William was known to have been medicated and on antidepressants. So why isn't this being looked at?" And then he gives the black box warning from actual psychiatric medication. Here's what it says. This is on the black box. This is what, if you read the black box, if you're on an antidepressant, it would say, quote, "Call a healthcare provider right away if you or your family member has any of the following symptoms, especially if they are new, worse, or worry you. Thoughts about suicide or dying, attempts to commit suicide, new or worsening depression, new or worsening anxiety, feelings very agitated or restless, panic attacks, trouble sleeping, new or worsening irritability, acting aggressive, being angry or violent, acting on dangerous impulses, an extreme increase in activity and talking, mania, and other unusual changes in behavior." My God, that sounds like someone was eavesdropping on a Pacifica National board meeting or any of the 5 local stations' board meetings. This is all they manifest. So, what you have to understand is that this is what people are not told. Now, I'm going to share some thoughts on the death of Robin Williams from Marcos Torres and myself. First, if you looked at his career, I think anyone who has seen his films, like the Dead Poets Society or his Vietnam movie, one of his best, will appreciate him as an actor. I also appreciated him as a comedian, especially his ability to skew, almost as interesting as Mort Saul, who I felt was a master of it, and without the humor and a lot of tragic irony, Lenny Bruce. And that's one of the reasons I went to see him in concert. But also he made some life choices that in retrospect were not the best. First, he began to hang out with people in his field who shared certain common conditioned maladaptive symptoms. They did a lot of drugs, they did a lot of alcohol. There was no filtering mechanisms between their impulse and the likely outcome of doing something. As a result, whatever they wanted, they took. There was no indulgence they wouldn't go to at some extreme, and because they were popular, their agents, the people around them were making money from them, where were the people to step in there and have that come to Jesus conversation that, look, you keep doing this, you're going to destroy yourself, your reputation, any legacy you might have built for yourself is going to be washed away, because remember people for the worst they were, not the best they were. I don't know if anyone close to him or a part of his life and success had that conversation. But clearly he didn't get the message. If they did, or he didn't care. And unfortunately, I've seen this too often. Why? Because I have counseled thousands of celebrities. I've counseled some of the most famous people in the world, most powerful people in the world, some of the wealthiest people in the world. And I befriended people who are in a position to be a part of the whole entertainment community, the publishing community, the movie community. I've had very close, long-term friendships with these people, so I get to see it from the inside. I get to see people without the makeup, without the group of retainers and hangers-on, just them, one-on-one. So I get to see what's behind the facade. And what I see more often than not is deeply dysfunctional person that has mastered the art of disguise. Insecure, afraid, and filling their life with objects, toys, compulsions, and addictive behavior. And it doesn't end well for any of them. Also, getting into marriages when you're not ready to be the right person for yourself, how in the world could you be the right person for anyone else? And when you get out of those marriages, more often than not, you're even more insecure. And then one day, like Robin Williams, he wakes up and he's dead broke. He has no money. So everything that he worked for is gone. It's gone for all the wrong reasons. And now at 60 and broke, he becomes depressed. When you're no longer married, for whatever reason, that's none of my business or anyone else's business, but that's going to cause you, if you're just a human being, to question what happened. Why did it go wrong? What lessons weren't learned? That's normal to cause depression without attributing blame, because we don't know. It's none of our business. When your career is no longer high, when you're no longer the first person people want to see when it's a comedy, when there are other people who've come and taken your place, when the baton has been passed, whether you want to give it or not, when you can do your occasional concert, but that's not enough to pay for your lifestyle, so your whole lifestyle changes. Easy enough for these. And then you have a heart problem, and it nearly kills you. And that was due to your lifestyle. So you survive that, but then you're always wondering, will today be the day that I have a heart attack or a stroke? And then we don't know what else was going on in his life. If you've used as much drugs and alcohol as he and so many in Hollywood and the entertainment industry do, every drink, you're burning through a million brain cells. Boy, you say you got 100 billion, fine. And how many heavy alcohol bouts have you had? So you've probably burned up a substantial amount and your brain's shrunk. So your memory's going. You don't want people to know that. You don't want people to know that your memory's going. You hide it. I know a very famous person and a very beloved person. And there's always a person with this person. And I won't say who he is. He's a very nice man. But he forgets everything. So he'll smile. He knows how to smile. Hi. And whatever you say, he's going to agree with. Oh, do you remember I saw you in that concert? Yes. So he's gotten a few ways that he can get through that moment of interacting with the public. Let me tell you what this man does. This is the sad part, because this man's been a close, close friend of mine for my entire time in New York City, my whole career. I'm not just someone we know, someone we have dinner together and long conversations and just share creative energy. He'll come by my office at 10 o'clock in the morning, punctually, and he'll say, "Hey, Gary, I'm having a problem. Can you help me?" "Sure, sit down." I'm forgetting stuff. Do you have anything?" So I take a protocol out and I hand it to him. We talk for about 15, 20 minutes. He leaves. The very next day he comes back. "Hey, Gary, I'm having a problem." "Really?" "Yeah, my memory. Can you help me?" I give him another one. He's done this 100 times. The trouble with dealing with people who have dementia, they don't remember. They don't remember what they have forgotten. As a result, he has no idea he's been in there every day. And unfortunately, he's surrounded by people, in my personal opinion, who are just interested in the money. Could he be changed and helped? Yes. But nobody's going to allow him to take that 1 or 2 or 3 months to detoxify and rejuvenate, because he's a cash cow. And that's how it works in the world we live in today, more often than not. So we don't know how bad the damage to his brain, his memory, was to Robin Williams. But the likelihood is he was suffering from brain damage and neuron damage and memory loss and possibly even dementia. Don't know for sure, but if you've done that amount of alcohol and drugs, there's only one outcome. So when you look at a person and they're all questioning, why was he depressed? Because you're not looking at all the other pieces in the context of his life. You're taking him out of all the things he's done as if those didn't count, as if there wasn't a consequence. There's a consequence to every single thing you do in life. And then he takes the antidepressants, and they're known to cause suicide. So get someone who's feeling really bad about life, who doesn't feel they have the energy, maybe even the gift anymore, maybe not the originality, not the sharpness. And they don't want the public to see them unless they're at their best. When you saw him in Good Morning Vietnam, you saw him at his best. What would he be like today? There have been people who've given me clips of concerts they've gone to with some of the famous rock and rollers and musicians of the 1950s and 60s, and it's embarrassment. They forget. There's no energy. It's just terrible. And yet these people have to perform, and some people come to see him. They don't want to give up what they have. That's all they know. We don't know that part of Robert Williams' life. That's a missing factor. This is what we do know, or should be concerned about. This is an article from Marco Torres. Quote, Robin Williams was found dead yesterday at his home near Tyburn, California. The actor and comedian was 63. Authorities are still investigating the circumstances of death, but one thing that is known, that he was battling severe depression. A mountain of studies have shown that antidepressant drugs are largely ineffective, yet many Hollywood stars are hooked on the happy pills. Might we finally need the warnings and shake ourselves out of our pharmaceutical stupor? Women have a 10 to 25% risk greater than men, and men have a up to 12% risk of developing severe major depression in their lifetime. The use of these drugs has tripled in the last decade. And the use of antidepressants has soared 130%. Dr. Mark Hammer, a public health research at University College London, shows that people on the older drugs, the tricyclic antidepressants, are at a far higher risk of cardiovascular disease than those taking the newer class of pills, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But tricyclics were discovered in the 40s, and it is only now we have identified these dangers 60 years later. Moreover, some SSRI drugs are known to cause serious problems such as stomach bleeding. In addition, the withdrawal symptoms can be so severe that patients may become dependent on them for life. Dr. Hammer says his findings do not only affect people with depression, because antidepressants are also prescribed to people with back pain, headache, anxiety, and sleeping problems. 25% of American children are now on psychiatric drugs. And according to the CDC, one out of every six children are developmentally damaged. Do you ever wonder why so many people on psych drugs are committing suicide and homicide these days? After all, decades ago, there was no school shootings at all, or bizarre child suicides, or homicides like those found today. Years ago, the Genome Project identified the main metabolic pathway needed to metabolize up to 50% of all psych drugs and street drugs. Common psych drugs such as Adderall, Halidol, Risperidone, are on the list that needs the cytochrome P45 gene 2D6 in order to be metabolized. 2D6 refers to the most major metabolic liver enzyme. Perhaps more than 10% of Caucasians and a percentage of Asians and African Americans do not have the 2D6 activity. These folks cannot metabolize up to 50% of the psych drugs. These non-metabolizers are given more and more psych drugs as they become more and more psychotic until they hang themselves, kill someone, or become disabled in a mental institution, foaming at the mouth. One leading expert, Randolph Ness, a psychiatric professor at Michigan University, argues that mild forms of depression are beneficial, often interjecting in life to tell us to stop what we're doing and reconsider. This can help, he says, when something awful happens to us, such as job loss, relationships break up, when it makes sense to slow down and to grieve, reassess, and make changes. But instead, we live in a world that tells us that when we feel out of sorts, we need to take a pill to recover. In this belief that creates cues of patience at the doors of hard-pressed general practitioners who often feel that they have no option but to hand out happy pills as though they were candy. Many patients later claim they couldn't have coped without them. They will swear that the drugs made them feel better. But they don't look at the problems. Loss of bone density, weight gain, male infertility, heart disease, committing suicide, attempted suicide. In fact, there's more. It also causes panic attacks, low heart rate, lightheadedness, induced mania, psychotic symptoms, electrolyte disturbances, and seizures, even the inability to achieve orgasms. There are literally dozens of other side effects, too numerous to mention. So that is another perspective. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. We have a lot more to share today. No place safe, how cities are making it illegal to be homeless, and bottled water companies getting their water from the most drought-ridden places in America. Is that ethical? Is it moral? It may be legal, but shouldn't we be looking at this from a different perspective? And then my guest in the second part of our program is Professor Sandy Tolan, professor at the Annenberg School of Communications Journalism, University of Southern California. And we're going to talk about what do the Israeli and the Palestinian people and their leaders need to do in order to have a lasting, just peace for both. But first, just a couple of announcements. I'm going to be doing, starting in mid-September, a three-month, once-a-week intensive health support group for people who are diabetic, overweight, high blood pressure, cholesterol, any one of those four, or in some cases, a person may have all four. It is not based upon medicine or stopping seeing your doctor. Rather, it is based upon lifestyle and behavior modification, though it will be medically supervised. To qualify to get into it, you have to have those conditions and have proof of them and have a letter from your doctor, and then you can call Lou Anne Panessi and see about getting into the study group. And so that's how you get in. A lot of people are wanting in, but not everyone has proof. And because this is a legitimate study, we have to have proof that you had these conditions and to what degree these conditions changed because of lifestyle modification. So you need to do that. Now, write this number down if you're interested, because you'll call Lou Anne and speak directly with her, and then she is making the selection. 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198. Got a good special for you. Got two good specials. How about the first one? During the month of September, and possibly into October, you're going to be able to select an art film of your choice, one of the really good films, not the blockbusters you see in the regular movie theaters. These are at the Angelica or the Film Forum or the Quad or the Lincoln Plaza or Lincoln Center. And we're going to start the evening, probably four or five people, no more. We'll have a gourmet vegan dinner at what I consider the finest vegan vegetarian restaurant in New York. Then we'll walk or drive a cab, which I'll pay for. I'm paying for the meal and the tip. And then we're going to go to an art film that you have selected. And then after the art film, we'll either walk back uptown or take a cab. And you'll finish off with dessert that you can eat or take home with you. Probably be about 5 to 6 hours together. $200. It's a different way. It's the lowest thing that we've offered as far as price, because our sister station offers it for $400, and we're asking it for $200. And when we did it for Broadway Play, it was $600, and it was wonderful. We had over 100 people join us. So if you'd like to join me, I'll be with you. We'll have wonderful conversations for a whole evening, plus a great movie, a great meal, and dessert. I want you to know it's only $200, and I'm going to give you a number to call so that when you call in, you can get the evening together. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. It'll be a wonderful evening. 877-627-5065. And we also have another special today. We only have left, that's it, and then we'll be out of it for probably about 8 weeks to 10 weeks, survival stuff. And today we're offering the survival stuff powder. It's a gallon with a finest split pea protein, brown rice protein, alfalfa, pumpkin seeds, flax seeds, barley grass, kale, carrots, cauliflower, cabbage, parsley, ginger, spinach, celery, broccoli, asparagus, collard greens, apples, bananas, cranberries, strawberries, chlorella, spirulina, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, kamut, oats, all these sprouted grains, which mean they're gluten-free, quinoa, kamut, spelt, amaranth, oat beta-glucan, chia seeds, five types of sea vegetables like alaria and dulse and laminaria, proteolytic enzymes like amylase, lipase, cellulase, papain, bromelain, 8 billion, with a B, billion probiotics, non-dairy. All that high-quality protein, outrageously wonderful taste, and you're getting, and this is vegan, this is non-GMO, you're getting 17 grams of protein and 15 grams of fiber in each serving. That's why it has to be a gallon. So this is the stuff that if you want to have something that replaces the ultimate, the lifetime diet shake, it does. I use it. I have it right now because when I'm driving all night, I don't have the advantage of stopping any place to eat. So I have my powder. I put it in some spring water, and I'm good to go. Now, I've been using this for a long time. I'm the only one who's used it. In fact, I made this for myself. And then I started thinking, what about if there's a disaster? What if there's any kind of accident? What if there's a reason that people do not have regular access to food for a period of time? What are they going to do? And we've all seen the tornadoes. We've seen the hurricanes. We've seen the flooding. We've seen the fires. We've seen the earthquakes. We see how quickly life can change when people are unexpecting this to happen, and then where they have no way that they can be helped unless there is a rescue to feed them. What if there's not? What if there's a solar storm? So I just plan ahead. So this is why I call it survival stuff. So at least you will have it. You can use it in the interim, but if you want to have two or three bottles, that way you're the one who's going to have something, the best of the best. So you're not going to be falling over from not having the nutrients you need. Others, they're not going to be, if there's a disaster, there's no place they can get it. You're going to be the lucky one. So I only have 160 bottles left because we sold out of this completely, mainly through a fundraiser for the station. So here's what you do. You can call. Here's the number you call. It's on sale. It's normally $200. You're getting it for, I think, $130. I'm not sure what the price is, but it's a big discount. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Be smart. Have it. It's there. It's just the powder today. That's it. And you get it. Use it. Enjoy it. Save it. Give it to someone who doesn't have something. and it'll make a difference. 877-627-5065, Survival Stuff. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. We're going to go to our guest in just a moment, but I was just informed that our social media person who helps with all of our Facebook and Twitter is in studio. Aubrey. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi, Gary. How's it going?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to swing by and give you a quick update on our Facebook and digital website numbers, which have reached some skyrocket highs this week. We're in the 7.1 million for views to our Facebook and Twitter and website. So that's some really exciting news. And we are also having about 10,000 users, unique users. So it's their first time. So what this tells us is that today, more than ever, people just aren't really trusting the objectivity of popular news sources, and they're coming to us for their information. So that's really exciting stuff to see. And I also thought you would be interested to know that our male and female followership is pretty much split right down the middle, with about 70% female on Facebook, 30% in male, and then in Twitter, it's the exact opposite, about 65% male and 35% female. So
We have people as young as 12 years old listening.
That's right.
We have teenagers. We have a lot of group of people in their 20s. And a huge group in their 30s. Our average age is 35-year-old college-educated woman, self-empowered, wanting more information. Is that an accurate description based upon the Google Analytics?
That's right.
And so just in the last 7 days, we've had this 7 million views.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we'll keep the articles coming every day. Tomorrow, a brand-new original in-depth investigative reporting piece that Richard Gill and myself have just finished on genetically modified foods and pesticides, and that'll be posted. We try to post dozens of articles a day from progressive minds around the world, and calls to actions, and documentaries, some different documentarians on social issues. And we don't take an ideological frame of reference. We just look for the truth. We're not left, we're not right, we're wherever the truth is. Thank you, Aubrey, for bringing us up to date on that.
You're welcome.
Let's say hello to my guest, who is, I'm assuming, out in California, Professor Sandy Toland. Hi. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, how are you? Good to be with you.
Good. And, by the way, Professor Toland also received the George Polk Award. He's received many awards, and he is the author of The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and The Heart of the Middle East, and the forthcoming Children of the Stone, which is interesting. The issue is this. Immediately after Hamas won democratic elections in Gaza, its leader wrote a letter of reconciliation to George Bush, recognizing Israel's right to exist and returning to the 1967 border agreements, also to unify the Palestinian government with Fatah in the West Bank. However, the thrust was to immediately label Hamas only as a terrorist organization by the U.S., Europe, and Russia, and Israel. Why was Hamas's outreach ignored? No one's discussed it in the press. And why was this opportunity not taken to reconcile the Palestinian question, which we can call in today by reframing the old Jewish question that gave us the rise of Zionism? So why aren't we looking at the truth here?
Well, first of all, thanks for asking me to be on, Gary. I appreciate it very much. I do want to clarify one thing. There was a letter that was handwritten and delivered by the founder of a group called the Jewish Peace Lobby, someone who was very interested in the two-state solution, Jerome Siegel of the University of Maryland at the time. And he, in a meeting, wrote this letter. It was not an explicit recognition of Israel, but it was what one could call for sure a de facto recognition of Israel. He basically said, we are so, Hania in this letter said, we are so concerned about stability and security in the area that we don't mind having a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. Now that essentially, along with other signals Hamas had sent previously, with a and among other things, something called the Prisoners Document. This was a de facto recognition of Israel, and they also said, we're offering a truce for many years. This is essentially a starting point for a very fruitful conversation. I think there are a number of reasons why the U.S. didn't even respond to this. First of all, you have to remember, it wasn't that long ago, but in a way it seems like quite a while ago, that we were in the middle of pursuing a war in Iraq that had been justified on weapons of mass destruction. The United States, through the Bush administration, Cheney and all the people that we probably remember or would sometimes like to forget, they were trying to remake the map of the Middle East in Iraq and elsewhere. And to engage with an organization that had been labeled not only by the U.S. and Israel but others as a terrorist organization was not in the plans, and it was absolutely something that the U.S. couldn't stomach. However, it was a blown chance, because if you look at the history of organizations that are considered terrorist by, going back to the British, there were two organizations, the Irgun and the Stern Gang, who were responsible for bombings and massacres, and were labeled terrorist by, in some cases, the United Nations and by the British. Later, the heads of these organizations became part of the Israeli government. Yitzhak Shamir and Menachem Begin became prime ministers of Israel. They were involved with these, and they were leaders of these organizations. You could look at the classification of Yasser Arafat and the PLO as a terrorist organization. They later signed the Oslo Declaration of Principles, which led to the unfortunately ill-fated Oslo process. And we can get into that later, because I believe that was sort of doomed from the beginning. But nevertheless, the point is that groups and individuals that are labeled terrorists become, when they reach out, if you reject their overtures or don't at least investigate them, then you opt for war. And that's what the United States and Israel did in 2006 by ignoring this letter. Shortly after, about 3 weeks after the letter, Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier, was kidnapped, and that led to one of a series of devastating attacks on Gaza and literally overkill on the part of the Israeli government.
Could you address something that is not discussed, at least I cannot find it discussed at all in the current dilemma, the economic issue? Because there are those who are reasoning that the U.S. military collaborations are extremely lucrative financially for both nations. So this begs the question whether continual war with Gaza, and increasingly with the West Bank, is being spearheaded in part by a private military-industrial complex and its Washington supporters. And as long as this tight relationship exists, where revenues depend upon ongoing bombing and destruction of Gaza, I don't see how there can be any overtures to peace between Israel and Gaza. Is there any truth to this?
Well, I think if you look at just the numbers, you'll see that this argument has some credence. I'm not one who believes that there is a sort of a monolithic policy that is all agreed in advance and everybody got together and said this is how it's going to be. I mean, just like you have different traditions in America, you have a colonial tradition, you have a tradition of racism, and you have a tradition of justice. I mean, you look at the people who've stood up for justice, they're just as American as the legacy of genocide in the 19th century against Native people. So, I mean, in a similar way, I think you can't say that there's a monolithic way of looking at U.S.-Israeli policy or U.S. policy in the Middle East. But clearly, though, the military alliance, the military industrial alliance between the U.S. And Israel is extremely significant. I mean, I'm looking for my notes here, but I mean, basically, you're looking at, first of all, $3 billion a year, and essentially, you're talking about basically military aid, and then you're looking at just the hardware itself that the U.S. Has sent to Israel just since January 2012. You're talking about just in the hardware itself for since that time. You're looking at howitzers, rocket launchers, bombs, missiles, directed aircraft. Obviously, you've got the F-16 and the Israeli the use of the Apache attack helicopters. I mean, this is to show the sort of ironic juxtaposition of these so-called efforts for peace and calling by Obama, President Obama, for restraint on the part of Israel during the recent Gaza war, or during the unfortunately ongoing Gaza war. I mean, at this very same time that the U.S. called out Israel rightly for the bombing of a U.N. shelter that killed 20 people, the Pentagon simultaneously that day resupplied the U.S.-funded arms depot of Israel for its ammunition, basically approving the continued killing of children and families in its attacks on Gaza. So you have this sort of these two things working together. It's not quite that the one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, but it's that the government is so large that you have sort of simultaneous pursuits that are often at odds with each other.
A lot of people in this audience may not know the difference between Hamas and Fatah, and mm-hmm. Fatah and the Palestinian Liberation Army, and that when you hear Sean Hannity and other people who, they're not stupid, they're fully capable of understanding an argument, but they take out of the equation when they make their arguments that that Hamas represents all the Palestinians. They do not, even in the general election that brought Hamas to power. Why did they get in power? Because Fatah was so corrupt, the Palestinian Liberation Army was so self-serving, it was so filled with corruption and taking the money, and here the Hamas came along and built hospitals and fed them, and not that they were doing it with a benevolence, but they understood Maslow's law. And as a result, whoever's feeding you, whoever's giving you what you need in this emergency, you're going to pay attention to. But they still only got 44% of the vote. The other got 40%. Another group got the rest. So they don't represent all the Palestinians. So my question is this. Should all Palestinians, including those who are anti-Hamas, who do not support Hamas, who may have supported initially, voted for it simply because they thought that they would be helped with their food, a job, or something, and now see how they do not align with them, should all these people be collectively punished because of whatever Hamas is or is not? That's number one. And
well,
number two...
the answer is, of course... Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
Yeah.
The answer is of course not, but I would not put a line between increased justification for attacks on civilians who may have supported Hamas versus those who didn't. That would be a grotesque dividing line, which I do not support at all. The fact is that Hamas, I am not a defender of Hamas, and their attempts to terrorize Israelis by lobbing rockets into Israel is a violation of international law. But it has to be pointed out, first of all, that the civilian death toll in this current conflict is unfortunately even more grotesquely disproportionate than in past conflicts. You're talking about something close to 1,400 civilian casualties by UN estimates out of the 1,900. And three civilian casualties as well as 64 soldiers on the Israeli side. The Iron Dome, generally speaking, works. So first of all, to equate Hamas, and its destructive abilities with that of Israel is really quite absurd. But also to say that a family that supported Hamas because Fatah not only was corrupt but had not delivered anything in the way of not only a peace deal but even the corridor that was long promised under the Oslo process to connect Gaza to the West Bank. Fatah delivered very, very little. It took years for them to deliver even a slight reduction in the number of checkpoints in the West Bank, which still number more than 500 in a territory the size of Connecticut. Okay, so somebody who wants to opt out of that and who today may support Hamas simply because the status quo of blockades is unacceptable and they want a chance for something else, to target those people because of their support, as opposed to someone who didn't support Hamas, I mean, there should be no dividing line.
I would agree with that. My final question, the reports coming out of Gaza, as we know, are horrendous. You're looking at not surgical strikes. You're looking at the entire decimation of an infrastructure, power plants,
yes,
hospitals, schools,
yes,
factories, everything that you could do to stop a person from having any capacity to want to stay in a place or be able to stay in a place is being done. It's a scorched earth policy. It reminds me of what photographs look like on of the Allies bombing Berlin at the end of the World War II. Now, it also is a dehumanizing process. And what are your views as to the ultimate goals of both Israel and the United States in the eradication of Gazans?
Well, I think the U.S. is hamstrung by its support for Israel and the domestic politics of the Israel lobby in the United States. I don't think the U.S. is specifically interested in the destruction of Gaza, but they have acquiesced to the Israeli policy, which is, in my view, interested in that. I believe if you look at the policies of both Ariel Sharon, when he was prime minister, and actually long before in other capacities, and Benjamin Netanyahu, clearly they are not interested in a Palestinian state, and clearly they are interested in destroying the infrastructure for such a state. You just have to look at their actions, and you can go back to 2002 and look at even in regular news accounts from Serge Schmemann at the time in the New York Times, this was about destroying the infrastructure of the state during the Second Intifada and Operation so-called Defensive Shield by Sharon. Similarly, they are destroying in Gaza, have destroyed the infrastructure of whatever kind of state that might be forged between Fatah and Hamas, and in Gaza in this case. I believe that the whole thing has been motivated largely by the effort to destroy the unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas. And the irony is that unity agreement is not dead. It probably will be revived, and the people of Gaza who have survived will be set back years or decades.
Final quick answer. What positive suggestions could you offer that could give both the people of Israel and the people of Gaza an opportunity to see a way of reconciling?
Well, I would say for one thing, I'm reluctant to give advice to people in their own society, but I will say that the effect of dehumanizing the Palestinians, of refusing to even allow the Bet Salem, the respected human rights organizations, to take out an ad on Israeli radio simply naming some of the children who were killed by Israeli forces. That's close to the ultimate in dehumanization and in a way to create the other into an enemy that you're justified in killing, and in making insane statements like the one that Joan Rivers made about Palestinians deserve to be killed. This is a essential dehumanization that can only be addressed by humanizing your so-called enemy. So that's one thing. In terms of the long-term future, I believe that there will ultimately be a Palestinian state. I don't know what form it will take, but the existing reality, as even Israeli politicians have begun to point out, if it continues, and I would say right now, is a de facto apartheid condition. There are a lot of differences, but it's a de facto apartheid condition, and that's unacceptable in long term. An agreement that links the Palestinian people in many of their disparate locations, especially in Gaza and the West Bank, is in the interest of everybody, including the United States, to forge a durable and just peace.
I thank you very much, Sandy, for sharing your thoughts with us today.
I thank you for inviting me. You take care.
Professor Sandy Tolan, T-O-L-A-N. He's a professor at Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, University of Southern California, and he has spent nearly 30 years traveling through the Middle East and the Balkans and Latin America, focusing on the relationship between conflicts, ethnic identities, and natural resources and global economy. To complete our program today, I wanted to share some insights and some perspective on the tyranny of the nanny state, where the government knows what's best for you. I'll begin with John Whitehead from Op-Ed News and then share my own perspective. We all have seen them. We've seen the security cameras. We've become a surveillance state. Government agents are listening in on every phone call, reading every single email and text message, monitoring your spending, what you check out of a library, what you buy in a store, which movies you watch, even the porn. Everything about your health, they know. These are also the people that are putting in zero-tolerance policies. They are the ones who want political correctness. These are the ones who have the belief that we should have the militarized police, that it's okay to have SWAT teams who once were there to protect us against, let's say, a real terrorist threat, or a bombing, or a kidnapping, or a hostage situation. Now they'll burst in your door, they'll throw a flash grenade to serve you a summons. Think it's impossible? It's not. Now police, such as in Austin, Texas, were videoed a smackdown arrest of a person who was jaywalking, a student who was out jogging. It was an empty street. They jogged across it, and they were arrested. Why? What is the purpose of this? This is part of the nanny state. These are the people who want to take away our right to have supplements. They want to harmonize the Codex Alimentarius. In that context, they believe that you shouldn't have more than 45 milligrams of vitamin C in a supplement per day. 1.3 milligrams of B1, 1.6 milligrams of B6. They have no basis in science for saying that. Virtually all the gains that have been made in public health have been what goes against the nanny state. They have no problem with you eating GMOs. In fact, they promote it. They have a big problem if you want to grow organic vegetables in your backyard. They don't have a problem you drinking, let's say, chlorinated and fluoridated tap water. They have a big problem if you decide to collect rain from a cistern. In fact, a man's in jail now for simply doing nothing more than collecting his own rainwater. This is the nanny state. In fact, John Whitehead, in his book, documents this. He wrote the book, and I've had him on this program, The Government of Wolves, the Emerging American Police State. In fact, I interviewed him for my series that many of you have purchased from the station as a fundraiser called Fascism, Inc., which I document the whole history of fascism. I was maybe one of five talking about it at one time in the media. Now there are hundreds. Let me quote directly from John Whitehead. Quote, "This is the tyranny of the nanny state, marketed as benevolence, enforced with armed police, and inflicted on those who do not belong to the elite ruling class, who call all the shots. This tyranny disguises the better good, explains the recent rash of parents getting charged with negligence and arrested for leaving their kids alone for any amount of time, whether at a park, in a store, in a car, in their front yard. Another sign of what C.S. Lewis referred to as tyranny exercised by omnipotent moral busybodies. For example, working mom Deborah Harrell was arrested, spent 17 days in jail, lost the custody of her daughter, and if convicted could spend the next 10 years in jail, all because she let her 9-year-old daughter play alone at a nearby park. Single mother Shoshana Taylor, unemployed and essentially homeless, was arrested for leaving her kid in her car while she was in a job interview directly inside and had sight of her kid. For the so-called crime of allowing her 7-year-old son to visit a neighborhood playground located close to her own house, Nicole Ganey was interrogated, arrested, handcuffed in front of her son and transported to the local jail, where she was physically searched, fingerprinted, photographed, and held for 7 hours, and then had to come up with $4,000. She now faces third-degree criminal felony charge that carries a $5,000 fine and 5 years in jail. A Connecticut mother was arrested after her 7-year-old daughter, who wasn't wearing a helmet, fell off her scooter. That's right. Patricia Juarez was arrested after letting her son play at a Legoland store in the mall while she was shopping next door. Tammy Cooper was arrested, jailed overnight, and charged with child endangerment because Tammy let her kids ride their scooter in front of their house in a cul-de-sac at the end where she lived. Now, she could see her kids. They were right in front of the house. But the police arrested her because you weren't there with them. Unfortunately, having allowed our fears to be codified and our actions criminalized, we now find ourselves in a strange new world where just about everything we do is criminalized, not just our parenting decisions. As with most of the problems plaguing us in the American police state, we are the source of our greatest problems. We have relinquished control over the most intimate aspects of our lives to government officials who, while they may occupy seats of authority, are neither wiser, smarter, or more in tune with our needs, more knowledgeable about our problems, no more aware of what it is really that is in our best interest. Yet having bought into the false notion that the government does indeed know what's best for us and can ensure not only our safety but our happiness and will take care of us from cradle to grave, that is, from daycare centers to nursing homes, we have in actuality allowed ourselves to be bridled and turned into slaves at the bidding of a government that cares little for our freedoms or our happiness. The lesson is this: once a free people allow the government inroads into their freedoms or uses those same freedoms as bargaining chips for security, it becomes a slippery slope to outright tyranny. When our government no longer sees us as human beings with dignity and worth, but as things to be manipulated, maneuvered, mined for data, manhandled by police, conned into believing it is in our best interest at heart, and then jails us if we dare step out of line, punishes us unjustly without remorse, refuses to own up to its failings, we are no longer operating under a constitutional republic. Instead, what we are experiencing is the pathocracy, tyranny at the hands of a psychotic government which operates against the interests of its own people except for favoring certain groups. So where does that leave us? Having allowed the government to expand and exceed our reach, we find ourselves on the losing end of a tug of war over control of our country and our lives. And for as long as we let them, government officials will continue to trample on our rights, always justifying their actions as being in the good of the people. The choice for us is clear. It is the choice between tyranny and freedom, dictatorship and autonomy, peaceful slavery and dangerous freedom, and manufactured pipe dreams of what America used to be versus the gritty reality of what it is today. And most of all, perhaps the choice before us is that of being a child or a parent, of obeying blindly, never questioning, and marching in lockstep with the police state, or growing up and challenging injustice, standing up to tyranny, and owning up to our responsibilities as citizens, no matter how painful, risky, or uncomfortable. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you for listening in, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.